Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies. I'm your host, Roxanne Panchassi, and my guest today is Sanya Perovic, author of The Calendar in Revolutionary France, Perceptions of Time in Literature, Culture, Politics, published in 2012 by Cambridge University Press. Hi there, Sanya.
Hello. Hello, Roxanne.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for the interest. It's a great opportunity.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in working on France and the study of the French Revolution in particular.
Yes, it was a bit of an indirect pathway. My background is, as an undergraduate, I studied philosophy and literature, and I did a PhD in comparative literature. So I'm not a historian by training. And over the course of my graduate work, I was interested primarily in French theory and German philosophy and so forth. And as I got acquainted with the Enlightenment period and the Romantic period, I had noticed there was a lot of references to time. I mean, Wordsworth in his poetry talks about spots of time, and we have Rousseau, of course, is very much interested in different temporal experiences. And then as I started working more closely with the 18th century, I realized that the one period that's sort of missing out of the 18th century, for literary scholars anyway, is usually the French Revolution. And as I was elaborating, I think I wanted to do a PhD dissertation on some aspect of a philosophy of time or philosophy of history. And then I came across the French Revolutionary Calendar, and it was such a odd artifact sitting there that I became interested in the calendar as an object. And then through that, actually, I had to learn a lot about the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. So it was actually interest in time and theories of time that brought me to revolutionary time in general, and then the French Revolution in particular. So through the back door a bit.
So for listeners who don't know anything about the history of the revolutionary calendar and who may or may not know very much about the French Revolution, Sanya, can you just give us a very brief, I mean, I realize you've written a whole book about the revolutionary calendar, but a very, just to get us started, as a sort of basic overview of what was the French Revolutionary Calendar? You know, when was it introduced?
Okay, sure. The French Republican calendar, as it was officially called, was introduced actually in 1793, and it was backdated to 1792. People might be familiar with it through Walter Benjamin mentions this revolutionary calendar, but it's probably today most famous for declaring 1792 to be year one of a new timeline. And it also replaced the 7-day Judeo-Christian week with a 10-day week that was called the Decade, with the new day of rest was supposed to be the Décadi, the 10th day of the week. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be a metric week. And it replaced all the saints with fruits and vegetables and the names of farming utensils. So, I don't know, the name of St. Francis, or the day that was formerly dedicated to St. Francis, became the day of the pumpkin. And Christmas, I think, became the day of the dog in its original sort of formulation. So it was a calendar that combined the desire for rupture, the desire to efface all aspects of the Ancien Régime, including Christian chronology dating from the birth of Christ. It's very much an Enlightenment product insofar it was trying to institute a metric or decimal understanding of time. Mm-hmm. for those of you who might not be aware, the metric system was also introduced during the French Revolution. And finally, there was an attempt to strip back all the sort of symbolic accretion of the Gregorian calendar to get back to a kind of natural astronomical time of planetary revolution. So one of the things the calendar really captures is the sense that the term revolution, and this was quite strong in the 18th century, referred to, often was used in the plural and referred to astronomical revolutions, the kind of cyclical time of nature, and not just the unidirectional time of history that we associate with the term revolution.
You know, I was excited to read this book because I've always, as somebody who teaches modern France and studies modern France myself, that I do have always had this kind of fascination with the revolutionary calendar, but realized that I don't know a lot. I didn't know a lot about it before reading your book. I know a great deal more now. And so I'm curious about that. You know, anyone who studies the revolution hears about the calendar. It's certainly mentioned very often as one of the features of revolutionary culture, but not very often discussed in a sustained way. And I just wonder, you know, why do you think that is?
Yes, well, I think the primary reason is that it failed. So I think generally historians and people who study the past are more interested naturally by successes or influential influential sort of processes. It was in place for almost 13 years, but it sort of limped towards its demise. Most people associate it with year two, which would have been the first year it was instituted because it was backdated, and with the Jacobin regime. I find it an interesting artifact because even though it failed as a functional time frame, nonetheless, it succeeded, I think, in imprinting itself on the political imagination. So we have a situation in which the idea of the revolutionary calendar gets resurrected several times throughout history. Under the Commune, they briefly claimed to be in year 79 of the French Revolution, so they resurrected the timeline. Auguste Comte also thought that he had his own calendar that was in, I think, year 61 of the Great Revolution. Under the Soviets, there was a brief attempt to resurrect the calendar. So I think it succeeded as an ideological gesture and as reflected a certain desire for rupture, but it failed for all practical purposes. So I think it both is important for understanding the French Revolution. For example, 18th Brumaire, these famous dates, all of them borrow from the calendar. But it failed as a functional object, I suppose.
Well, and having, you know, pointed out that it's perhaps not always explored in a great deal of detail in studies of the revolution and overviews of the revolution, yours is not the first scholarly engagement with the history of the Republican calendar. And I just wonder if you could say something about how your study departs from or adds to previous understandings of the calendar within the context of the historiography of the French Revolution or ideas about time. I mean, just sort of briefly before we get into the details of the book.
Yeah, so I think my sense is that there have been a couple of monographs written on the Republican calendar in particular, a recent one by Matthew Shaw. There was an earlier one in 1992, I think, by someone called a German historian called Michael Mainzer. My feeling is that most of these people are interested in tracking the calendar's influence in everyday life. So the approach is more a social history approach to see to what extent replacing the 7-day Judeo-Christian week with the 10-day decimal week, to what extent that might have actually changed the rhythms of market times, church going, the times people can make appointments and so forth. I came through it more from a theoretical angle. I'm very much influenced by Reinhard Kozelek. And he wrote a very big essay on the term revolution and all its different meanings it has accrued over time. But he also wrote a very short piece on the concept of new time and the calendar. And he made the observation that it's a very paradoxical object because on the one hand, it's absolutely modern in its attempt to change history. And yet there's something paradoxical about using a calendar, which is very much indebted to cyclical time, in order to kind of imprint one's consciousness of living in a new time. So he thought that the desire to mark the sense of this is new, we've made a revolution, everything's going to be new, that sort of historical consciousness is incompatible with calendars that generally tend to be about coordinating people and society and several societies sometimes in a kind of in their everyday habits and also religious belief and so forth. I think there's a tension at the heart of the calendar that I was interested in exploring. And I think historians have explored this, but my feeling is more from the perspective of social history.
I mean, that concern with the sort of tensions between this linear conception of time and a more cyclical model certainly runs throughout the book. And I just wonder, you know, there was a particular, I get the sense from the book that there was this particular tension for revolutionaries between this idea of a return to maybe a better past or an idyllic past, a state of nature, versus this rupture and the creation of an entirely new world. So are you arguing that that's a particular contradiction in the case of the French Revolution?
Yes. I mean, I guess it would be a contradiction for anyone who tried to create a new calendar from scratch. Most calendars are sort of syncretic objects that are developed over a long period of time. And even when societies or nations or peoples create a new timeline, generally it's the case that these things are retroactively instituted. So, for example, with the Gregorian calendar, the Christian timeline is something that took a very long time to establish itself. Even in the medieval period, people were still dating according to Roman regnal years.
Hmm.
So I think it's anybody who wants to create a new timeline from scratch will run into the problem that it's very hard to identify what the rupture moment is when you're in time, right? Because life goes on in a way. So that's a general problem. And specifically for the revolutionaries, yes, I think they were very much, I mean, I'm not the only one who thinks this. Most people would say they were very much invested in the idea of a restoration or a regeneration or a return to, as you say, a more innocent time, a state of nature. And in fact, I think one of the things they were trying to do with the calendar was to strip it of its Christian connotation and go back to the astronomical time of the Julian calendar. There was this belief that beneath every calendar, there is a natural solar time, and that the goal of the revolution is to get back to that natural time that in which time would be transparent and we no longer need festivals and religious festivals to mediate between us and the time of the year that we're in.
You describe the project of the book from, you know, the introduction on, Sanya, as at least in part, an attempt to understand how the French Revolution was constructed in its own present. That's a sort of phrase and idea that you use. And I just wonder, you know, what does that mean to understand the revolution in its own present?
Yes, I should preface that by saying, of course, it's impossible to know what was going on in the minds of the revolutionaries. However, I thought it was an interesting sort of intellectual experiment to take seriously what they were trying to do, I suppose. I think there's always a tendency to assume that things that have failed were always destined for failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of my sort of challenges of the project was to try to get back in the mindset of people who had every reason to think that their attempt to create a new time and to symbolize it might succeed. And again, this is an approach that's influenced by Kozelek insofar as this attempt to resurrect the future of the past, not the future that actually came to pass, but the multiple futures that they were faced with. You know, only one of them became the future of the French Revolution. But there's obviously a whole gamut of possibilities that were open in their own present. So I think that's what I tried to do with it. Of course, I understand it's a bit of an impossible task to try to relive the past. But it's also an attempt to read the calendar as a kind of lyrical object, instead of just treating it objectively from the vantage point of our vantage point of historical distance, to try to understand a little bit better the emotional imagination, the projection, the hopes that this calendar embodied.
Mm-hmm. You begin the book, Sanya, well, the project of the book as a whole does this, to sort of broaden our time frame, to look at by looking at the pre-revolutionary origins of the calendar, you know, not just seeing it as something that emerges at the moment of the revolution, either beginning in 1789 and certainly not just in 1793 with the institution of the calendar. So can you say a little bit more about these pre-revolutionary origins of the calendar? Where did this idea come from, and what are some of the antecedents of this project?
Yes, well, I have to confess that when I started working on this project, I had absolutely no real idea of what calendars were for. I mean, of course, I used one, but I had no. I was quite ignorant of the kind of deep cultural history of calendars in general, and so one of the things that struck me as I studied this more and more was how deeply fixed the temporal concepts that they were trying to overturn really were, and in a sense are. So I think they were very much influenced. There was a number of sort of radical Enlightenment thinkers, such as the Cours de Gebelin, who were very much interested in almanacs, different calendars of different civilizations, because they were very much interested to find out what the origins of state-based civilizations were. And they were interested in the Egyptian calendar, in the calendars of the Near East, and they had lots of... The zodiac was a very, very popular topic that was discussed in quite detail. So they were interested in calendars as a kind of artifact that allowed them to actually do a kind of comparative history of different civilizations, because what these civilizations shared in common was a certain use of astronomical time. So there was a number of erudite thinkers that were interested in calendars in general. Of course, throughout the 17th and 18th century, there wasn't just one calendar in Europe, and there was a kind of ongoing battle between those countries that accepted Gregorian reform and the Protestant countries and cantons and areas that were very slow to accept what they considered papal influence. So even in the mid 18th century, a number of countries, the Protestant cantons of Switzerland or didn't actually accept the Gregorian calendar. So they were in effect living on a slightly different timeline. So I think for the 18th century, there was actually a deeper familiarity with different calendars and different ideas behind calendars than perhaps there is for us today.
Mm-hmm.
And then just to add to that, of course, there was the omnipresence of the medieval, what I call the medieval Christian calendar, but the kind of liturgical calendar, the sort of images and symbols associated with that. I think that was still very much deeply embedded in everyday cultural life for these people. So there was a number of sort of reference points that they could think about when they thought about calendar time. The specific antecedent for the revolutionary calendar is something called the Almanach des Honnêtes Gens that was published by Sylvain Maréchal, who I discuss at length in the book. And this was an attempt to... He was one of the first who abandoned the Christian timeline to be in what he called year one of the reign of reason. And he invented a calendar in which, instead of saints for each day, he picked exemplary figures from the past and also from the present. Mm-hmm. And he mixed and mingled a lot of people that weren't supposed to be put together. So on his calendar, he had Moses and he had Muhammad and he had Jewish Jesus and Jewish figures and atheist figures and kings and courtesans kind of all commingling. And that was, of course, immediately censored. So that's the actual prototype of the revolutionary calendar, is this Almanach des Honnêtes Gens that was published in 1788.
It's really fascinating, and Sanya, you've also already talked a little bit about this idea of rupture, and at the beginning of the book, you certainly outlined this in the introduction. And then when you're talking about these pre-revolutionary origins, you come back to this idea of rupture. And I just wonder, you know, what was the significance of this idea of rupture for revolutionaries? And how was the calendar, the Republican calendar that comes in 1793, dated back, how was that calendar intended to express this idea of rupture?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know if I have a good answer for it, but certainly one of the things that strikes anyone who studies the French Revolution is how far-reaching some of the changes were, and also how much didn't change, I suppose. But certainly my sense is that for most of the participants, they wouldn't have been able to make such far-reaching claims about the novelty of their society if it was if they believed it was truly new and unprecedented. I think what allowed them to go so far in some of their reforms, such as the abolition of feudal privileges on August 4th, 1789, and so forth, was a belief that they weren't actually going into the scary, fearful future, but they were actually recalibrating society on a more natural and egalitarian basis. So I think rupture for many of these participants was very much overlaid with the sense of regeneration and restoration. Now, in the case of the revolutionary calendar in particular, the supporters of this or the calendar, some of them were more committed to a much more radical idea of rupture, which is to destroy the three pillars of the Ancien Regime. It was clearly anti-clerical, so against the church. It was meant to erase all memories of the past. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to kind of establish a new egalitarian relationship between people, because it was thought that the church calendar encouraged social hierarchy and difference. So I think it's a big question. I don't have a straightforward answer, but my sense is that if rupture wasn't accompanied by a strong belief in the regenerative possibility of revolution, they might have been less eager to go ahead, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, in some ways, I wouldn't expect you to be able to answer that question in a couple of minutes. The whole book kind of engages this idea of rupture. Your history of the calendar, and you've already mentioned Sylvain Maréchal, the history of the calendar is also in some ways a sort of political, literary, and intellectual biography of this figure, Maréchal. So what can you tell us about him? What role or roles did he play in the French Revolution, apart from and alongside the invention of this Republican calendar?
Yes. Well, one of my challenges when I started working on this topic was, how do you access representations of time? I mean, time is a kind of a fluid, liquid thing. I mean, we've got instruments that tell time. That's what a calendar is to some extent. But what about different conceptions of time? I mean, and so I started looking into the Sylvain Maréchal, who, as I mentioned earlier, invented the prototype of the revolutionary calendar. And he is an absolutely fascinating figure. He is most well known, actually, for having participated in the Conspiracy of Equals with Babeuf, which was the first, that was in the 1790s, the first revolution against the revolution, or the first revolt against the revolutionary state in the name of a true revolution that was supposed to redistribute property, amongst other things. So he's known in some circles as the first communist or even anarchist, because he really, from the beginning, actually, he was a militant who participated in almost every single phase of the French Revolution. He wrote a play in year two, which I guess is his other famous piece, The Last Judgment of All Kings. And in this play, he corrals all the kings, the remaining kings of Europe, monarchs of Europe, and the Pope, and exiles them to a volcanic island where they are guarded by a kind of squadron of sans-culottes until the volcano explodes and they all perish. And that was quite a controversial piece at the time, as you can imagine, because most of the monarchs that he represented were actually alive and waging war in France. And he was an anarchist insofar as from the very beginning, even though he participated, he was the editor of one of the most radical newspapers, the Révolution de Paris, that was Prudhomme's journal. And he was from the beginning critical against any kind of state, really. So he thought that at the end of the day, the only true revolution had to involve leaving the state behind and going to live in what he called the small archipelagos of family units, in which property would be shared in common, and there would be no no social hierarchy. So yeah, a fascinating figure that has had some influence for subsequent revolutionary movements of the 19th and 20th century.
I'm just curious, you know, as a writer, researcher, and a writer, you know, when you're trying to do this project that is a history of these conceptions of time and the calendar as an object and one that symbolizes these changing ideas, was that a challenge to work through your attention to Maréchal's biography and the biography of the calendars? Was that hard for you writing the book and putting it together?
I think it certainly was. It might come across sometimes, maybe for some readers of the book. Trying to keep these two lenses, kind of reading, not just telling the story of the calendar, but also telling the story of its inventor. And what I find interesting about these two narratives is that Maréchal's career mimics the career of the calendar so well, because he hit his greatest limelight in year two when the calendar was instituted. Maréchal subsequently fell out of favor with the revolutionary regime, and by the time he died in 1803, he was more or less forgotten. And I think this mirrors very well what happened to the calendar. It was instituted in year two. It was supported by the majority of the elite, actually, which is quite surprising that something so radical would garner so much support. And it too limped towards a kind of, it kind of petered out of existence in about the same time as Sylvain Maréchal himself did. So what I tried to, essentially, I was telling the story of two failures, I suppose, or two conceptions of the revolution, the one embodied by the calendar, the other one by the writings of Sylvain Maréchal, that didn't succeed historically to make much of a mark, although one could argue that the impact of these ideas in the political imagination remained very strong.
You point out, Sanya, that there was a lag time between the end, and I'm doing rabbit quotes right now, the end of the old regime and the introduction of the revolutionary calendar. Why was this the case, and what was the significance of this lag time?
Yes, maybe I make perhaps a bit of a rhetorical spin on this, but what I found interesting in learning more about this is that the king was deposed, as many people know, on August 10th, 1792. The calendar wasn't instituted until September 1793, and even then it took about a couple of months for the various debates to occur in the convention about what kind of calendar people wanted and so forth. So certainly there's the lag time between the time they declared that they needed to update the existing calendar and the time the new calendar was implemented. There's further lag times insofar as year one, in a way, it's a funny sort of year. It doesn't really belong in any calendar. 1789 was actually declared to be year one of liberty. Then August 10th, 1792, when the king was deposed, was almost immediately declared by the popular press as year one of equality. Then you get the institution of the calendar on September 22nd, 1793, and now that's the official year one of the French Republic.
Right.
So you have multiple candidates for the status of year one. And I thought another very interesting thing that I noticed was that even though the king was deposed on August 10th, 1792, when the calendar was instituted, they chose to commemorate the opening of the convention as the true beginning of year one, and they sort of ignored the political events that led to the downfall of the monarchy, mm-hmm. which is another example, again, of having a preference for natural symbols over those of history, because September 22nd was the day of the autumn equinox, and it was supposed to represent the moment the day and night occurred in equal measure. And the calendar, in a way, especially with its kind of poetic imagery, the months named after the seasons, the fruits and vegetables, and so forth, you might notice that there aren't any references to actual events of the French Revolution in the mm-hmm. calendar.
Is this connected to this notion that you talk about in the book, Sonia, of the idea that the narrative and the chronology of the French Revolution were not identical?
Yeah, obviously there's many different narratives of the French Revolution, obviously, and they were already there from the beginning, depending who you were and how you felt about it. Mm-hmm. But certainly there's a way in which there's this narratives that we tell ourselves now about the French Revolution, and they rely on our conventional chronology. Mm-hmm. So we have dates 1789 and 1790 and 91 and 1793 and so forth. What I find interesting is that many of the current narratives of the French Revolution still rely on Republican dates to demarcate important turning points. Nine Thermidor.
Right.
When 9 and 10 Thermidor, when Robespierre was deposed, that's still referred to as 9 and 10 Thermidor. Mm-hmm. I was fairly ignorant when I started studying the French Revolution, so it took me a while to know that it was July and so forth, 1794, because it's such a shorthand that people refer to 9 Thermidor.
Sure.
And 18th Brumaire, when Napoleon did his coup, is another date that really I had to look up to see exactly when it happened and what the year was and so forth. So there's a way in which current historical narratives rely on Republican dates. That's mm-hmm. one element. And of course, within the revolutionary period itself, there were conflicting chronologies ongoing at the time. That's why the calendar, I think, is so fascinating, because it was used by the participants to impose, depending on who they were, one narrative over another mm-hmm. at various times, because it was in place for almost 13 years.
I couldn't help but think, you know, reading this part of the book that, you know, when I teach the French Revolution, I think I already frustrate my students enough with an inattention to chronology. I was thinking that, yes, it's true. I teach them, you know, 9 Thermidor, 18 Brumaire, and that's about it, I think, in terms of the revolutionary calendar. But introducing these more complex, I think I'll drive them crazy if I introduce this sort of competing notions of time, but it is quite fascinating to me. And I guess it's connected to me too, with this notion that, you know, I suppose a too simplistic periodization of the French Revolution, but one that, well, I certainly rely on to a certain extent in my teaching, mm-hmm. it divides the events of the revolution and the story of the revolution into these phases, right? A liberal or constitutional phase, a radical Republican phase, and then this sort of reactionary, post-Nine Thermidor phase, yes. Reactionary phase. And I'm just wondering how the history of the calendar fits with, how your history of the calendar fits with or challenges this kind of conventional shorthand organization and periodization of the French Revolution.
Yes, well, what I tried to do with the book, and this was kind of the gambit, I suppose, was to ask the reader, and I think it also will frustrate the reader as well, to ask the reader to keep in mind two chronologies at the same time. Mm-hmm. One is our chronology, of course, that we use, and to also ask the reader to read along with the Republican dates in mind, as if the Republican calendar was the calendar that was the official one at that time. So I repeatedly in the book refer to Republican dates as much as I can, mm-hmm. even in year three or year four or onwards, in order to remind the reader, you know, this might be the period of reaction, but actually the calendar was very much still in place, and at certain moments of the so-called reaction, there was a return to the calendar and an insistence on it. So that's part of the reading of the book, I hope. Well, it's a bit difficult, but yeah, to keep in mind that there's actually the intended timeline, which I also argue, because they were trying to create a new timeline, that means a whole new time, a new future that was supposed to last forever.
Right.
To imagine that ourselves being in year three of the revolution, the way someone would be in year three of the Roman Empire. And at the same time, of course, keeping in mind that it was a failed experiment, we need to keep in mind that at every given moment in time, there was a revision. There was kind of ongoing revisionism during the revolutionary period. So that said, I would say that the contribution I hope to make to current periodization is to argue that perhaps this division into a liberal revolution that often is thought to end in 1792-93 to give way to the radical revolution, and that maybe neither of these are exactly the right terms to use, because both of them rely on a periodization that is aided and embedded by the institution of the calendar itself.
Mm-hmm.
So often people will say, well, there's two versions of the French Revolution, the liberal one that complains that all the good principles got derailed by the bad terror.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the more socialist interpretation that argues, well, the reason why the revolution went awry is because it never fulfilled its social goals or so forth. I'm trying to show in this book that it's very hard to disentangle these two interpretations, that even during the reaction, during the Directory, a lot of liberals supported the calendar for their own purposes, perhaps, but they nonetheless did. At the same time, those people who focus too much on the revolution's goals might not be as sensitive to how the actual events and the unfolding of events really changed the revolution's intentions. So I would say I tried to intervene on both sides of the debate to say that it's not so clear cut if we think about how long the calendar was in place and the wide range of people who supported it or didn't. Yeah,
I think the book is really effective in that sense of in you know, through this work on Maréchal and on the calendar to kind of open up our notions of how we organize the revolution politically and the politics of interpretation of the different phases, so-called, of the revolution. And that was really fascinating to read about. You talk, Sonia, about, you know, festivals and the festivals of reason and the festive calendar. And I do think that's one of the things that, you know, people who even have a cursory understanding of the French Revolution are really fascinated by, you know, these festivals of reason and the replacement of the old sacred with a whole new set of sacred mm-hmm. rituals, some of them quite intricate and some of them bizarre, you know. And I wonder how your story of the calendar and of Maréchal's work engages with this idea of a whole new, I know you're not doing a social history, but a whole new kind of way of approaching daily life and of and ritual. How does all of that fit into this story?
Yeah, I find this is a very good question. I myself am fascinated by the audacity of some of these experiments in creating mm-hmm. festive culture. I mean, the most perhaps well-known one is the Festival of Reason, where they replaced the central icon of Christianity, the Virgin Mary, with this living goddess who was supposed mm-hmm. to, in several of the theatricalizations, was supposed to unveil herself to reveal the triumph of reason over religion. I think that's quite fascinating. Of course, many people have worked on the festive culture of the French Revolution
mm-hmm.
And done kind of magisterial work on it. I think what the calendar allows us to do is to consider, I guess, first of all, the difficulty of instituting a new festive culture. What ended up happening, the revolution was filled with festivals, but very few of them have remained. Or some of them have, the celebration of the Bastille Day, or the 14th of July 14th is one of them. But the whole challenge of the calendar, and this is where I found it really fascinating, because it was supposed to institute a natural relationship to time, they weren't supposed to rely on what they considered to be the gimmicks of religion, which are the icons, the statues, the pageantry, the colors, and that was on the one hand.
And so yet,
they were supposed to be transparent. They weren't supposed to have any mediating object, and that's very straight out of the pages of Rousseau, I believe. This attempt to create a festive culture in which there's no sort of object of representation, that at any moment the spectator can become the actor for the other spectators, and it's all kind of like one communal village festival. So that was certainly one aspect of it. But the other problem they ran into is that without the gimmicks and the sort of pageantry, it's very hard to get people excited.
Right.
So you get this tension between reason that's supposed to be transparent and neutral and almost self-signifying on the one hand, and the desire to replace certain icons and images with other icons and images. Of course, the difference with the revolutionaries is that they were that they intended the imagination not to go beyond what could be sensed by the senses. I think that's the materialism and the empirical basis was quite strong. Yes, so the calendar. I think reveals a slightly different relationship insofar as it participated very actively in the kind of high point of the festive culture when all the most innovative part. What the revolutionaries quickly found out is that they couldn't quite control the people's imagination and the way they imagined. And you get a lot of a reaction against the carnivalesque. So the calendar was used as a kind of disciplining object. Have a festival the way we want you to have a festival, which is rational and ordered. But at the same time, it borrowed from this strong, radical, I call it radically atheistic, materialistic imagination that was prevalent.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, Sonia, and that is certainly a dominant theme in French history and French cultural studies, is this notion of sort of temporal issues, but also the notion of memory. And I'm just wondering what the relationship is here between the way that you're talking about the calendar and revolutionary time and Republican time and ideas about memory during the French Revolution.
Well, that's another fantastic, huge question.
I have a habit of asking huge questions. Sorry.
Yeah. Question from a Third Republic historian.
That's right.
Yes, I can't really. I did use a little bit. I was influenced a bit by my somewhat cursory reading, but of Halbach, Maurice Halbach's theory of collective memory. Mm-hmm. Certainly, what you see with the calendar is an attempt to wipe out all pre-existing memory and also pre-existing group memories. If we think of a society of orders, each social order, in a way, has its own way of enacting its group identity and its group memory. What the French nation was before the revolution was a kind of combination of several group memories, you know, the church with the liturgical calendar, the nobility that participated in the church, but also had its own way of commemorating the past. And then, of course, kind of the general public holidays and festivities of the people. So they tried to erase all these group memories and replace them with one sort of collective memory that was supposed to represent the memory of this new people, this newly regenerated people. So essentially what you get is they try to create a new memory from scratch. They didn't want any pre-existing memories to persist. That didn't succeed, of course. But what the calendar contains as a kind of trace material is of the conflict between different conceptions of group memory, I think. As each faction sort of took over power, they used the calendar to project, in a sense, their own understanding of how memory should function and how public festivity should function. So in a way, the calendar tells the story of it almost became saturated or oversaturated with conflicting memories of the revolution and conflicting revisions of the revolution. So I think out of its ideal, which is one collective memory, you get several narratives. And I guess you could say you get a moment in which a historical sense might trump this project of searching for a collective memory. So at the end of the day, the calendar becomes less about memory and more about history, about dates and events and struggles over the meaning of the terms.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, and I don't know if this is because I'm a Third Republic historian or not, but because you'd also said something about coming into this project through or from an interest in theory, French theory, that a couple of points in the book, this issue of Republican revolutionary space comes up. And of course, when people talk about time and temporality, maybe the too obvious question is, okay, what has this got to do with space? You know, how are these things connected? And you know, from architectural projects during the revolution to just a sense of the space of the nation, is there a connection between the history of the calendar and these ideas about temporality that you're exploring in the book and notions of space in this period?
Certainly. I think one of the images that one could associate with the calendar is that of a circle of cyclical time. And one of the predominant images that was replicated architecturally in some of the plans, future plans that never materialized for a new architecture, is this idea of a circle. Mm. And I think one of the revolutionaries actually says, you know, moral equality will be like a geometric circle. Mm. When we can all see each other and all occupy the same distance from the center, then equality will be achieved. So I think there's a way in which some of the utopian plans for new architecture, also the festivals, the way they were choreographed, all involved inhabiting space differently. And I think the idea of the circle as a kind of moral geometry.
Hmm.
And the idea of the calendar as embodying a kind of cyclical time of moral regeneration are very closely tied. In terms of theory, I would say certainly someone like Durkheim was very much interested, of course, in the revolutionary festivals. So there's a kind of reflection on the French Revolution that later gets taken up by French theorists of the 19th century in particular, and then the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So the last part of the book, Sanya, is devoted to the story of the calendars. You know, some of the terms you use are, I like these phrases, you know, the wearing out of the calendar, the piecemeal decline, this, you know, story of failure that you're recuperating as significant. But, you know, how and why did the Republican calendar fail? What is your assessment of those big questions?
Yes, in a sense, partly because I don't think there is an answer, but partly because I'm not a historian, I don't really have a causal explanation of how and why the calendar failed. I mean, people have given many plausible reasons.
Hmm.
Of course, one of them is that habits are hard to overturn. The other one is that perhaps it wasn't in place long enough. The metric system actually took quite a while to be established, and interesting to compare the calendar, which also attempted to sort of implement a decimal or metric time, with the metric reform of space. In the Cahiers de Doléances, there was a lot of demand for a new system that would standardize weights and measures. So that was actually a pre-revolutionary demand for new measures. In the case of the calendar, there was actually no popular demand for a new calendar. That makes it quite a different, much more ideologically driven project. However, if we think it took, I think, over 50 years for the metric system to be established. I mean, Napoleon ended up abolishing the metric system partly because he thought once the calendar was abolished, why not also abolish the metric system? I mean, he thought of the two as going hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
So an argument could be made that if it had been around long enough and there was enough top-down enforcement, that maybe it would have succeeded. But of course, the other big problem of the Republican calendar is that other European countries didn't have one. With the exception of the the Batavian Republic actually instituted its own revolutionary calendar briefly. So there was a kind of attempt to export the French revolutionary calendar to other countries briefly. And I think at one point some commercial travelers had trouble because I think the Batavian Republic was in year three when the French Republic was already in year five or something like that. So, but certainly Europe, most European countries didn't adopt a revolutionary calendar, and that made trade and commerce and communication quite difficult. I mean, that's one of the reasons that was given by Laplace when the calendar was abolished. Well, Europe lives in European time. We can't be insisting that we live in a different time. So in a sense, the return, abolishing the calendar was a way to return the French Revolution to a kind of European history. Mm. Whereas before that, there was maybe this is the birth of French exceptionalism to some extent, certainly the revolution is, but the sense that why not, the French Republic was supposed to be a new republic and therefore a model for the world. Mm-hmm. One of the things I find interesting as a kind of inverse of that question is to say perhaps there wasn't a realization of what the time of tradition and habit was until something so audacious as the calendar actually failed. That perhaps one should maybe reverse the question and say what the failure of the calendar showed was the deep fixity of tradition and habit. Mm. And that was perhaps, in a way, a discovery.
It's interesting. You say that, I think somewhere in the beginning of the book and then again at the end, you talk about the fact that the calendar was adopted with very little opposition and then sort of abandoned with very little opposition. And I just wonder, you know, given how ideologically driven, as you pointed out, this project was, it's sort of curious to me that there wasn't more resistance at the outset and then resistance at the moment of its abandonment. That what do you think accounts for that?
Yeah, I think certainly on the part of the population, there probably was resistance, depending on who you were and what your politics were. There would have been resistance from the beginning. I think the elite, they were educated from the same school, I guess, to some extent, and had imbibed the same sources and maybe were as enamored by the same ideals, and that they thought perhaps there was some objection that time, you know, is too difficult to change, but perhaps they were what they shared was a common hope and also a common belief in scientific progress, because mm-hmm. the calendar was supposed to represent an improvement on the Gregorian calendar, and one of its claims to fame, although that ended up not being the case, was that it was going to be a perpetual calendar. So instead of looking on the calendar today and wondering, are we October 1st and we're a Tuesday and so forth, we would know what day of the week we were.
Wow, that would be great.
Yeah, if we had a perpetual calendar. So I think there was a belief in science, and also a belief that I find quite fascinating, a belief that if only reason could prevail, consensus would prevail as well. So there was a dream of harmony, I think, that the calendar sort of exemplifies, that was shared by a number of people. And of course, by the time the revolution was over, that dream had been shattered.
Mm-hmm. You just said this thing about the revolution being over, but I was really struck by something in your concluding comments in the book where you say that and I'm quoting here, the Republican calendar served as a preface to a revolution that never really did end. And I find that, you know, sentence very provocative and fascinating. And I just wonder if you could, you know, what do you mean by that? And how did the calendar return? And what does it mean to say that the French Revolution never really ended?
Well, I think that's a paraphrase, perhaps from Hegel, so dates me sometimes. But maybe the revolution has finally ended. But certainly there's this debate. François Furet was famously said that the revolution mm-hmm. was over in 1989. I think for my purposes, I'm more interested in the 19th and 20th centuries. There's a way in which this dream of a new time and a year one and a new beginning keeps on popping up over and over again. And in that sense, it's a preface, because in a way, year one is one of those dates where there almost, it's almost an absurdity to talk about year 15 and year 20 and year 89. And yet the hope of every year one is that there will be a year 18 and a year 89 and a year 1023 and so forth. So I think in that sense, this dream of beginning anew is something that has stayed with many people, not just in Western Europe, but also in all the different places where the revolution was eventually exported. Each big revolution has a similar, arguably a similar relationship to time. I'm not so familiar with the Maoist revolution, but I think one can find a similar sort of thought process. Of course, many of them are imitating the French Revolution, but I think there's a way in which the calendar forces us to think of the revolution perhaps more lyrically than some historians might be inclined. So the question is not just how did this particular French Revolution that began in 1789, how did that end and when did that end? But to what extent is that opening still a possibility or still an opening? And that requires us to think of that particular year one, not as something that can be aligned on any given chronology. You can have any number of year ones and they can be any place in time. So in a sense, it's a very overdetermined moment, but it's not a moment that allows itself to be foreclosed in a way that one might want to foreclose something like the French Revolution began in 1789, ended whenever, 1799 or 1848 or whenever you think it might have ended.
You say at the beginning of the book, Sonia, and certainly come back to this notion throughout, that this idea of the story of the revolutionary calendar containing the history of our own modern time schema, you know, pointing to some of the much broader implications of this book, not just for our understandings of the French Revolution, but for how we think about time from, you know, the 18th century right up to the present. And I wanted to ask you about that, how you see the calendar fitting into this alteration of the notion of modern time.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And it has a quite complex, many-faceted answer, because one of the difficulties I had working on this project is, of course, there's a kind of ubiquity of our own calendar, which is the modern time schema that we're most familiar with. The Gregorian calendar has now become the de facto global calendar. So whether you're in India or in Russia, people might have their own calendars, but generally the calendar of commerce and communication is this Gregorian calendar that the revolutionaries tried to overturn. So in a way, the revolutionary calendar is very unmodern. It is both compulsively modern in the sense that it wanted to establish itself and its idea of new time as a new time, and so I'm not being very clear. It was compulsively modern in the sense it attempted to break with tradition, and that was its kind of fundamental aim. So that, in that sense, I think it contributed very much to our sense of modern time as consisting of rupture and several ruptures and constant novelty and newness. So that's definitely its modern aspect. But its unmodern aspect, I think, lies in the fact that it was symbolically overdetermined. What allows our current Gregorian calendar to travel so well is that essentially its religious references have sort of faded with time. And that allows other people with their own religious traditions to use it. And also, my feeling is that the way we use a calendar today is very much as a kind of empty grid. You know, when we open our agendas, when we made this arrangement to have our interview today, we're usually faced with a bunch of blank squares on a page.
Right, the iCal moment.
Yeah, exactly. So in a way, to live in today's world, in a modern time schema, is to have an idea of time as an empty space. Or as Benedict Anderson famously said, the idea of modern time as the time of simultaneity. What a calendar allows us is all of us to coordinate our actions together. I mean, that's what all calendars do, but certainly that becomes more important as the world becomes global. So this is an aspect of the revolutionary calendar that definitely didn't make it to this world. And I think it's symbolic overdetermination, its intentionality, both makes it extremely modern, but also unmodern. And also its belief in the final ultimate predominance of cyclical time, I think, makes it something that didn't survive the present. So I think it's both contributed to our idea that history consists of rupture, and there's all sorts of ruptures, and historians talk about epistemic ruptures and these ruptures and those ruptures. There's, of course, revolutionary history. But at the same time, there's something in the calendar that resists this modern sense of time. And I find it straddles both an unmodern world — I know that's not a real term — but an unmodern world and a modern time schema.
Well, Sonia, I've taken up a lot of your time, but I'd like to ask you one last question, which is, what are you working on now?
Oh, good question. I'm in the very beginnings of a new project that tentatively is titled World History as World Court, The Theatrical Origins of Human Rights. And I'm, again, interested in this idea of the way history gets set up, in a sense, as a moral tribunal in which you can be on the good side or the bad side. So the new project continues my interest in a kind of politics of time. But I would like to take it back to the 18th century, look at theater in particular, and to see, I know human rights is a very loaded term, but to see to what extent there was an attempt to use theater as a way to stage man and to stage a new idea of man as a kind of universal being.
And will this project be focused on France as well, or?
France and hopefully Germany as well. I think there's a lot of interchange, especially in the world of theater criticism, between Germany and France. But it's still in its early stages, so we'll see what happens.
Well, it sounds really fascinating, and I look forward to seeing it appear in various forms in the future. I just want to thank you so much, Sonia, for joining me today and illuminating this period of French history and this object of the revolution that is really so interesting.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure for me.
You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.